Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports. I'm Andrew Hansen.
And I'm Lauren Fox.
Yeah, I'm just confused. Like, we walk into the studio, I feel like I should now be hitting left-handed and playing first base.
And
instead of roaming the outfield.
And I should be throwing lefty and looking like Randy Johnson.
Well, I'm like, we walk into the studio, the microphones are backwards, the headsets are backwards, everything is funky. Harry's going to be so mad.
And it's not our fault.
I know. We're going on the record right now. Harry, it is not our fault. We didn't do it. I like when things are nice and left in an orderly fashion. Today, I don't know.
Not to mention, we're starting about 45 minutes late.
Right.
So they are really putting the challenges to us today.
Seriously. Yeah. It's
the radio gods.
It's raining. It's warm and kind of weird. I don't know. So, but I guess if it's warm and kind of weird, it's spring almost. We're in the thick of March Madness. And, well, we're not quite there yet, but right now this is, to me, one of the most underrated weeks of college sports or sports in general. It's NCAA conference tournament time.
Championship week.
ESPN has branded it Championship Week, which I'm sure they have sponsorships that go along with that. But we've seen a lot of interesting things this week. And as much as any of the pundits want to get on ESPN and say, all right, these are your last four in and these are your first four out. Well, we saw it last year when my beloved USC Trojans, because of some grudge that the NCAA had against them, some foreboding something or other, next thing you know, USC doesn't make it. They probably should have made it. They're done for this year. They lost to Washington. Their season is over. And Washington right now is everybody's one team from the Pac-10 that's actually going to make the tournament, Pac-12 that's actually going to make the tournament. But with all of the talking, first of all, I don't know why we care about who the last four in are and the first four out are, because when we're thinking about that stuff, those teams, nobody's going to win it. It's
true.
The chances that a major conference team is going to get into the NCAA tournament as a late at-large bid and really do a whole lot beyond Ket Bass the first weekend are slim to none.
Yeah, it's never happened before.
It's very infrequent.
In terms of winning the tournament. They can get past the first weekend, but no one has ever won at all.
No, but what we've seen are the interesting mid-majors that kind of catch lightning in a bottle, basically, at the right time. The best example or the most fun example, we had George Mason do it a few years ago. Loyal of Chicago, everybody's sweethearts. Butler did it on a number of occasions.
Wichita State.
Yep, exactly. Just a number of them will catch lightning in a bottle at the right time. They get hot. They figure it out. There is something to be said for having people who are invested in the program. And this is not me dismissing talent in any way, shape, or form, but there's something to be said for having people who are really invested in a program. And when the coach says zig, they zig. And when the coach says zag, they zag. And sometimes the coach doesn't even say it. And I'm sure there are a number of things that we're going to talk through. But did you watch that Christian Laettner thing on ESPN? Did you wind up watching that?
I saw part of it.
So you get to a point, and this, granted, that was late 80s. So, I mean, it's basically 30 years ago, give or take, before he was done. He graduated in 92. But he was at a point where his relationship with his teammates was so strong. The players on that team would have done just about anything for him. Coach K acted like he was a son. I didn't like Christian Laettner at Duke. I still really don't like Duke all that much because they're Duke. But watching that 30 for 30 gave me a different sort of appreciation for Laettner, but also gave me an appreciation for what it was like when you could year in and year out say UNLV is going to be good because Larry Johnson's coming back. Anderson Hunt's coming back. Oh, Moses Scurry's gone. Like you could look at the programs and sort of forecast a little bit from a prognosticator standpoint. It made things much easier because you knew year in and year out that who players were going to be, and barring injury, you look at it and say, well, this team comes into the season with a lot of veteran leadership, they're going to be good, versus this team comes into the season with some freshmen and we'll see how quickly the freshmen gel, which I think over time, over the last 25 years, we've seen it play in the hands of some of those mid-majors.
Yeah, it's because it's trended so much towards the influence of the freshmen. Now you'll see those mid-major teams who have the juniors and seniors, they have the advantage over some of the teams with top freshmen because they have the physical strength of juniors and seniors that the freshmen don't have.
Right.
They also have the experience and the chemistry of playing together for 3 or 4 years. But you're right, in terms of prognostication, now it's more about do you know the top 50 high school seniors that are ranked? Do you know how good they are, and have you seen them, and can you predict how they're going to be and how they're going to play together versus, okay, we've seen Leitner in the tournament for 3 years. We're not talking about what he's going to be as a freshman. We're talking about, is he going to graduate as the all-time leading scorer in the NCAA tournament history, like
right.
he did?
Which, that was an entirely different circumstance. And you forget about all the pieces that enter into a guy staying for that long and really largely building a program. Because as much as now we can look, and I was watching the Calhoun Project on ESPN. I watched parts of it, and they were mentioning Jim Calhoun going from Northeastern to UConn and how UConn was a program that really had no basketball history to speak of. And it wasn't a Duke and it wasn't a Kentucky. I as much as, again, not a Duke guy, Duke wasn't Duke. Duke is Duke. They are on TV more than Leave It to Beaver. But as much as you can say Duke now, Duke wasn't Duke. Like, there were times after Kay got there that they were ready to call for his head. He was done. And it was a program that really had little to no tradition. So I by all means, I appreciate everything that Calhoun did at Connecticut to build a program and really maintain a program until he retired. And the fascinating thing about the Calhoun Project is it's Jim Calhoun, because he loves coaching so much, going and coaching a D3 program. Like, that's brand new. It's perfect. It's a great fit.
Yeah, it really is. And to your point, the head coach of these institutions really has defined these top programs over the last 20 years. And earlier, when you're talking about zigging and zagging, I was thinking about Coach Mark Few at Gonzaga with the Zags, who always zag when he tells them to zag, and they're in the tournament every single year now, and they are the epitome of a mid-major who's now become a major
yeah.
because of the program that he's developed over the last couple of decades.
But you look at that program and say, are they, it's almost like the secret's out. It's almost like we know that a 12 is going to beat a 5 in the NCAA tournament. And that is a given thing year in and year out. The Gonzaga is, first of all, they haven't won one. As much as they've been around and close for so long, they haven't won one.
But they got to a title game.
They have gotten to the title game, but they haven't broken through. But for a Jesuit school from Spokane, Washington, like they're now, everybody knows who they are, which there's something to be said for that. So thinking back to college, and you mentioned the top 50 players, the number 31 player coming out of the class was somebody that a lot of people hadn't heard of until this week. Plays for LSU, Javonte Smart. And in case you missed this story, and you're the one with the legal background, so you're probably our subject matter expert on this one. The story goes as this. Will Wade, who's 37 years old, who's got a good track record by his own right coaching college basketball. He was a student manager, then a grad assistant at Clemson, worked his way up to VCU. Like, he's had a good career trajectory. He's only 37 years old. Again, there's that number. He's only 37, and he's now got LSU 25-5. Well, there's a scandal going on, and the scandal is you have Will Wade on the phone with Christian Dawkins, and the FBI has tapes of Will Wade talking to Dawkins, who it was basically, for all intents and purposes, an agent on behalf of Adidas, and basically arranging payments for a player. And in this case, it was Javonte Smart, the number 31 recruit out of that senior class. And LSU found out about it.
As we all have now.
As we all have now. And what they're trying to do now, really, is save their basketball program and save their athletic program. Because their problem now is potentially the dreaded lack of institutional control tag, which would seem to be coming. Because you know, Will Wade, I mean, I want to say his contract is 6 years, $15 million. Like, he's got a good-sized contract. The problem becomes Will Wade isn't paying this kid out of his own pocket. Somebody is paying the kid somewhere. And willing to bet if you followed that far enough up the food chain, it would probably lead right to the athletic director's office, because no coach isn't going to do that without some sort of blessing from his athletic director, which then, if the athletic director knows, there's your lack of institutional control right there. So LSU is doing damage control now. Put Will Wade on administrative leave, although he's still getting paid, which is funny. He will not talk to the NCAA on the advice of his attorneys. He will not talk to anybody, and he hasn't denied that any of this took place. So right now, I'm astonished by it. And I'm astonished by it mostly because of my single biggest thing, selfishly, is I remember having those 2003, 4, 5, 6 USC teams. The Reggie Bush, Matt Leinart, Lendale White. The star-studded teams that either contended for or won national titles. Reggie Bush won a Heisman Trophy. All that stuff went away because of what they deemed a lack of institutional control, even though nobody ever proved that Pete Carroll, the head coach at the time, was involved. You have now a head coach that was talking to the guy that was going to pay his player on an FBI wiretap. How will that guy keep his job?
Well, I don't think he will.
But it's like, he deserves nothing. Nobody should award him any points. May God have mercy on his soul. Like, what is he trying to accomplish?
It's unbelievable that he said those things. And the problem for him, among others, is even though he's caught on tape talking about the Smart transaction with that player, Smart,
right,
he was also referencing previous bribes that he had been involved with that were much smoother and easier,
right,
to complete. But it's interesting that you mentioned the AD, because we really haven't heard that much about ADs across the country in this college basketball scandal. It has always been about the head coach and the assistant coaches. But you really do have to imagine that at a lot of these institutions, the AD has been aware. Because it's a collection of the AD, the coaches, the boosters. They're all one big tight family.
Right. Well, and the same thing goes. You saw it. You see it there. And I guess at this point in time, it's 2019. If, as one of my good old friends says it, I'm surprised that you're surprised. But the athletic director at LSU puts Will Wade on paid administrative leave, and the crowd now chants for him to be fired. Not because they think that he should be fired because he's culpable. They want him fired because they like their coach. And they think that cutting the head off the Hydra is going to make it so that the coach's culpability is removed. Well, that's not going to be the case. Like, they're trying to harness their anger somewhere, but they're harnessing it really in the wrong place. The knowing how those athletic departments work, and knowing how boosters, let's face it, and this will lead us right into our next fun scandal. But scandals week here.
We must not be championship week.
We're going for ratings.
Week.
So there are boosters hanging out around these programs. Oklahoma State, who they named their stadium after? T. Boone Pickens. Like, there are people with ungodly sums of money that love their universities and will throw their money at the universities, not to endow scholarships or not to endow professorships, to buy football stadiums and to put their names on basketball arenas. And I obviously understand there's a lot of money tied up in all this stuff, not to mention the fact that with the athletes or student athletes that are playing, if you're not Zion Williamson or Javonte Smart or a lot of the guys that are going to be leaving after a year, if you're conscientious, you could get a 4-year degree out of that, and there's value in having a 4-year degree. Not necessarily if you're an NBA player. I don't know that you need a 4-year degree. There are a lot of careers that you really don't need a 4-year degree for, but there's value in walking out with a piece of paper just from the networking and the relationships and the maturity side of it. But you look at what's going on, and there's a lot of money that is being kind of thrown around. And you look at Will Wade and you say, well, if Will Wade's doing it, guaranteed there are boosters that are bankrolling this whole thing to make it so that better players come to the program so that you improve from, I think they had 17 or 18 wins last year to 25 this year. You have that, boosters throwing money in, but you'd be foolish to think that the athletic director isn't saying, hey, Will, or Joe Oliva isn't saying, hey, Will, I want you to meet so-and-so. Like, there's got to be some sort of introduction somewhere along the way. Hey, we're at a cocktail party, and yeah, talk to this guy. So to think that he is completely unaware that anything's going on, if he's, okay, one of two things. If he's aware of it, all right, he's at fault. If he's unaware of it, shame on him. He's the boss. Like, there's no real in-between that goes along with that. So, I don't know. And then to get to for the final chapter of Scandals Week for the week, USC, the college admissions scandal.
Right.
The flavor du jour. So, I'm not even going to say if you've missed this one, because there's no way that you have missed this one, because everybody is talking about it, because it involves Aunt Becky from Full House, Fuller House, as well as Felicity Huffman. I don't know how William H. Macy is somehow ignored from all this stuff. But basically what went on was you had a cabal of very wealthy people who were trying to get their kids into colleges. And rather than do it the old-fashioned way, which is you endow a building or a professorship or something, they went about it in such a way where, hey, we're going to fake my kid's SAT score, or basically unbeknownst to the kid, not even fake the SAT score, we're going to have somebody else take the SAT in his spot or her spot, get her into school, or unbeknownst to the kid, we are going to Photoshop pictures in. So here's little Joey looking like he's a pole vaulter, who then is recruited to pole vault.
Even though he's never pole vaulted.
Even though he's never pole vaulted. And the most shocking thing for me out of this whole thing is, when did USC not become a fallback school? Like, I mean, really. It was always a fallback school when I was a kid. When did it become a good school? And then does that make my diploma worth more or worth less? I don't know.
Probably more, since you got it in the legit fashion.
I don't know. I don't know. So, you feel bad for any of it with, they're somewhere along the line, because there's always a trickle-down effect that goes along with it. And this is always something when the NCAA comes in and says, we're taking away 15 scholarships. Okay, great. There are 15 kids that aren't going to USC on a football scholarship, which trickles down, because then there's a kid here who goes to LSU or Florida State, which trickles all the way down to smaller programs that ultimately, like, the kids that are kind of the, I don't even want to say bottom tier, but the lesser recruited kids now find themselves without a scholarship because the NCAA arbitrarily says we're taking scholarships away, which I've always disliked that as a punishment for that reason, because you're punishing kids and you're taking opportunity away, not from the star kids who are going to go to the NFL and don't care. You're taking, ultimately, it's going away from the kids that probably need it the most.
Yeah. And you feel for the kids because a lot of them didn't know this was happening. And you feel for the people who are associated with these individuals that didn't know it was happening, like apparently Phil Mickelson. He and his wife,
yep,
apparently
so
have...
So he says.
But they have a video clip on one of these websites endorsing it because there was some assistance provided to his daughter, who's now at Brown. But you feel for people like that whose image gets caught up in it that didn't know about it, and... You know, especially for the kids.
Well, there are so many things that blow me away about. Mickelson was somehow pulled into the thing. The company was headquartered out of my hometown, Newport Beach, California. Which, if you ever want to go to a place, and it's weird for me to look at it and say that the place that I grew up in doesn't exist anymore, but it doesn't exist anymore. Like, Newport Beach, California in the 80s, 90s, different place. This is, whoa, like, crazy. It's the OC, big time. And it's become a really hyper-competitive environment where people, and we all want the best for our kids, but at what expense do you want the best for your kids? And
6 million.
Again, I'm just, I didn't have, yeah. It cost me a lot of money to get into USC. But well, there are people now, and I also, I hate this side of it, and I realize hate is a strong word. I can already hear my wife saying that, but I hate this side of it. Somebody now sued Stanford for $500 billion, to which I just sprained my brain, rolling my eyes, because if you go in and you sue Stanford for $500 million, you're, unless it's a class action lawsuit, which I don't believe that it was, now you're at a point, first of all, that number is just asinine. But second, you're at a point where if somebody had a legitimate beef with why they didn't get into the school, you're kind of muddying the waters for everybody else, because I would figure, and again, you're the attorney, a judge would look at that lawsuit and go, you're out of your mind.
Well, what, I haven't heard about this lawsuit. What are they alleging? That because these other people were paying off whoever to get into Stanford, they didn't get in?
Is they that didn't the claim? Get in. It was a loss of opportunity to get in, and it's based upon future wages. And I'm sure there's a lot of punitive damages that go along with it.
Certainly have to be.
Because there's zero people on the planet for whom future wages would be $500 billion. There's one who's about one third of it. But, I mean, his goes up and down as Amazon stock price goes up and down.
Yeah, without knowing any more details about that lawsuit, the problem is, how do you prove that you would have gotten in even without these people? Because at a lot of these top schools, even if you have a perfect SAT score, only 10% of the students get in.
Right.
So how could you actually prove that the transgressions of this singer individual actually prevented you from getting into Stanford? I don't think you could.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Meanwhile, a lot of my old friends have been circulating pictures of, this is the picture that I put on my USC application, and it's bad Photoshop jobs. I threw a really bad one on the Fox on Sports Facebook page where I put Maggie's face on Randy Johnson's head.
And now she's a left-handed
gunslinger. Now she's a 6'10 left-handed pitcher. I don't know. I'm curious to see how that whole thing plays out. But getting back to fun, because this sports is fun, and like, there's a reason why I don't watch news. There's a reason why I make my coffee and flip on SportsCenter in the morning, because I want to wake up and see things like I saw this morning.
Which ones? About Zion?
Zion Williamson.
That is fun.
Boom.
13 Beast. For 13 from the field, 29 points in his first game back.
2 for 9 from the line.
Yeah. Well, I think most coaches would take that. If you're going to go 13 for 13,
you can go
2 for 9 from the line.
He was astonishing. Even like little floaters from the baseline, or watching him, he had a putback where he had about that long to hit the ground and come right back up, and somehow throws down a dunk. Like my only request of Zion Williamson is just be fun. Just be fun forever. Don't, like, I just need you to be fun.
I need you to bring
the joy back in.
He has.
Like,
he has.
Be must-see TV. That's what I, like, I was so excited to see that last night.
He is must-see TV. He's making plays that make it look like he's in the NBA playing against junior high kids.
Yeah.
My favorite play from last night, I thought you were going to talk about when you said putback, was when he went up in the air to get an offensive rebound on the left side of the basket. And he got it one-handed, kind of close to the baseline, but he brought the ball back into the proper angle to make the layup on the putback.
That was the one I was talking about, without, the little floater on the base. Yeah.
Without coming back to the ground.
Yeah.
So he did this amazing contortion with the ball as he was rebounding it to put it back up without even using his right hand. That is just a phenomenal play, and it was so fun to see him back and to see that we're going to have him here for March Madness.
I hope so.
And when you talk about him bringing back the fun to the game, he really is got that natural joy. If you heard his interview after the game on the court, he said,
I couldn't throw a tennis ball into the ocean from the free throw line.
I didn't hear that part, but I just talked about how, what I heard was him talking about how, you know, the pundits had been questioning whether he would come back or should he come back. And he said, I just couldn't leave my teammates hanging out to dry like that. I had to come back for them and play, and it's fun. And I want to be out here competing with my teammates.
And that's like, it's impossible for me to say, what would I have done if I was in his situation? Because you look at him and you say, if he leaves, he's still going to be the number one pick. If he doesn't play another minute of college basketball, he's still going to be the number one. there's potential for injury that goes along with it. But then you forget, I don't know if he's 18 or 19, but you forget with him that he is 18 or 19. And these are guys that he's played with all summer and all fall and probably on the AAU circuit. And these are guys that he knows. And like, for, I don't care whether it's a men's league or whatever, like, you become attached to your teammates, and or you should, and you feel like, I have an obligation to these guys. And like, that was, I think, an understated thing that as all of the talking heads were, and us included, were talking about it, that was something I don't think that we factored in, was that he's a kid who just, he wants to play basketball with his buddies. He's excited to be playing with them. Like, to me, that's the most, that's the fun piece of that story, is just like, he looked to me like he had the level of joy of, I throw a tennis ball for my dog, and he, not this dog, this dog doesn't retrieve. I throw a tennis ball for my old dog, and he goes bouncing after it. And you're like, this is the same day as every other day for me, but to him, this is the best day of his life.
Yeah.
Every day.
It was also
that.
It was also fun to see how they handled him, because he said in his interview he could have played a few games ago, but they wanted to get him, you know, what the phrase he used was, to 110%. They wanted to get his conditioning back where he was really ready to go and really be at 100%. And he went and played 36 minutes out of 40. So it's great to see that, you know, Duke didn't rush him back. They said, let's get him 100%. So we're not, there's no chance here of risking injury because he's going out there at 90%. And then he comes out and plays 36 minutes. Certainly it's easier to play 36 minutes when you're playing against Syracuse in their 2-3 zone. But he's talking about his stamina and his athleticism. I mean, those plays that he's making, like the first steal that he got, and then he's beating everybody down the court with that right-handed dunk. He's just this athlete that's ready to explode all over the court at any minute. It's like he's bouncing around with 25% more energy than everybody else, and he's ready to jump about 20% higher than most people in the NBA.
Yeah, so I don't know. Who's the worst team in the NBA right now? Phoenix? No, Phoenix has won some games, though.
They've made some moves. Kelly Oubre, the Jayhawk who I may like the least, has actually made a pretty positive impact on the Suns. They have won a couple games recently.
I was going to say, though, I don't ever remember him playing at KU.
Yeah, well, that's because when they were in the tournament, that was when they lost in the first or second round, and he's just running around carelessly, not caring that they're about to lose in the NCAA tournament on the first weekend, like the Jayhawks have done way too many times in the last 20 years. But
Bradley and Northern Iowa.
Yeah, he was on one of those teams that grossly underachieved, and it's in large part his fault because he didn't care about winning.
I think it's the coach, too, though.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
We're going to get into KU basketball talk now.
Yeah, why are our prized recruits guys like that and Wiggins, who just kind of move around the court aimlessly with no real purpose other than look good, hit some shots, and okay, I'll take my number one draft status and move on, and then I'll get my $150 million and continue to not rebound or assist.
Right, so I don't know. I'm curious to see where Zion winds up going. He's going to go number one. It's just a matter of who gets the ping pong balls.
Well, you asked who's the worst team. It could be the Knicks, and they could end up getting him.
There's no justice in this world if he goes to play for a team that's owned by James Dolan.
Oh, seriously.
So,
gosh.
And in case you missed
talk
this
about
one,
scandals.
Yeah, this is James Dolan, owner of the Knicks. Claims, so there was a fan after the game who yelled at James Dolan, sell the team. And James Dolan decides to engage the fan.
Yeah.
And, but like, the first thing you learn when you're in a situation like that is don't engage. Just walk away. James Dolan goes to engage this guy. The game's over. He has security hold this guy, which it seems to me to be a violation of the Bill of Rights, but hey, what do I know? He has security hold this guy. This guy should be free to leave. He didn't do anything. He didn't commit a crime. And then James Dolan gets on and says, this guy ambushed me walking around the arena. He was waiting for his opportunity. Okay. So we have that side of it where I honestly don't like that to me falls on along the lines of if you are playing or owning or coaching a team, there are certain things that are acceptable as far as heckling. To me, sell the team is well within the navigational beacons. You're good.
But instead, within about 12 seconds, he's banned this guy from coming back to the arena. You talk about an ambush. It was like Dolan was going to ambush him. It was like he had decided beforehand, if anybody ever yells something at me as I'm walking off the arena down the tunnel, I'm just going to ban him from the arena.
Well, he did the same thing with Charles Oakley.
Yeah. I mean, that's a little bit different because he got in a fight, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for this one, you're right. That's the type of thing that's free speech. It's the normal thing a fan might say. People say it all the time throughout New York. Every day people are saying that about Dolan.
Because he should.
Because they're
a laughingstock. They're horrible.
To me, it was more like he ambushed the fan, not that the fan ambushed him.
Well, and then he went on the talk radio circuit and pleading his case. And again, I'm going to go to you as my legal expert. If he's saying things about the fan on talk radio, does the fan have any right to go after him for slander?
No, because he's not. What he's saying is truth. He's talking about what the fan truthfully said.
But if he's saying that the fan was stalking him around the stadium, around the arena, and was looking to ambush him.
Well, if he's...
I mean, is that defamation at all?
If he's saying things that are false, then you start to get into defamation. So to me, it's you have to look at the context with defamation. Is he actually saying that he was physically... You know, if he's trying to make it like the guy was physically going to ambush him or physically stalking him, then you might start to trend towards defamation. But if he's just talking about the verbal statement that he did actually make, you can't have defamation.
Okay. So now that I've cleared that up, I was curious. So on the other side of it, the other big story coming out of the NBA this week, which was the top of everybody's radar, I think on Monday or Tuesday, and then immediately once the whole college scandal broke, everybody stopped talking about it. Fans in Utah saying questionable things to Russell Westbrook. And we all know, like, Russ is a passionate guy. But there are some lines that you just don't cross. And the fan was laying it on a little thick to Russ with some racial insults, to which some people have said he's making $35 million a year, to which I say, I don't care if he's making $35,000 a year. There is no place where that is appropriate. You wouldn't dream of yelling something at somebody at the checkout counter at Walmart. You wouldn't dream of yelling something at where
the employee is working.
Where the employee is working.
And you're yelling at the employee.
You wouldn't dream of doing that to a server. So why does the fact that you bought a ticket give you the right now to insult that guy? It's one thing to say you suck.
Right.
It's another thing to insult somebody's heritage, ethnicity. Not appropriate.
Yeah, and, no, nothing gives you that freedom.
Yeah,
When you're talking about what's within the boundaries of acceptable comments to an owner, same thing with this to the player Russell Westbrook, the fan had crossed the line, no doubt, 100%. It's not even debatable.
Right. And, you know, the frustrating things that happen, of course, you see how this is portrayed in various news media. I think, by and large, most people have said, you know, Russ may have... He may have gone a little bit too far, and the NBA acknowledged that with a $25,000 fine for him. But by the same token, then the owner of the Utah Jazz got up in front of the full arena yesterday and basically said, there's no room for this in our community. And the Jazz slapped the fan with a lifetime ban. And, hey, good for them.
Absolutely.
As far as handling that, I know that in the past, there have been players who have had difficulty playing in Utah because of similar things. And my hope, we're all humans. Like, we're all trying to row in the same direction. So there's no reason to do that. Because you buy a ticket doesn't entitle you to that. I mean, you know, you and I heard it watching a basketball game the other night. And it's, you buy a ticket, whatever, like, it's, you know, and I've always said this, it's fine to cheer. And it's fine to boo, and it's fine to, you know, to criticize somebody's performance. Great. But once you start going after something that there are just certain things that are just completely out of bounds. And just because you're there and you don't think the person can hear you, not appropriate.
Yeah, what you're referring to is we heard a comment at a basketball game from a fan who was actually a high school student that was inappropriate. And this type of incident on the grand scale of the NBA hopefully will teach a lesson to everyone who's involved in sports that it is unacceptable and that there can be consequences and there will be consequences for fans like that who act like that. But I want to turn the discussion to Russell Westbrook for a minute because of what was said and what I understand is that the investigations that took place after the fact by the Jazz, they resulted in a conclusion that the allegedly racial comments from the fan and his wife were actually said. So that Russell, when he described it to the media after the game, he was telling the truth, accurately describing what had happened. So they confirmed that. So with that being said, I am of the opinion that Russell Westbrook certainly should have the ability to respond, and we can't expect that he will not respond. You can get on a soapbox and say he should just keep his mouth shut because he's getting paid so much money and fans are going to yell insults, but I don't expect him to be quiet.
No.
I don't expect him not to respond, but he did cross the line as well. I'm surprised the NBA didn't fine him more and suspend him for the comments that he actually made.
I think it was almost a worth $25,000 to him out of his $35 million salary is a pittance.
Right.
I mean, it's like finding one of us $2. So there's that piece to, but unless you put it in that context for fans to any of us, $25,000 is a lot of money. And so when we hear that, we go, wow, they laid down the hammer on him, even though it's kind of just it's more of a gesture than anything else that the NBA said, hey, we got to do something. This is what we're going to do. I think, and I don't know what the answer is. Of course, the thing that everybody brought up was I still remember I was sitting at home in Olathe, Kansas, watching Malice at the Palace when Ron Artest went out. It was suspended for the remainder of the season. 73 games Artest lost because a fan threw a soda at him. And he went over the scorer's table and went, okay, first of all, you're at a game. What gives you the right to do that? But think about when that was. I believe that was the 2004-2005 season. So that was 15 years ago. We're fairly far removed from that. And sometimes what happens is, on everybody's side, the NBA says, it's not a problem anymore. Like, the players do what they're supposed to do. Nobody gets into it with the fans. We're good. And there's just kind of this, we're fine. We need to have fewer conversations with the players about it. And the fans, meanwhile, go, well, I can just kind of keep ratcheting up whatever vitriol I'm throwing at the player because the player's not going to respond because we saw what happened to Ron Artest. Like, nobody's going to do that again. And so it's far enough removed from all of that that now you have it where I think fans are kind of thinking, all right, I have free reign, and players, and I don't know what the NBA's process is. If I was the NBA at this point, I hate to ever say what somebody should have done in a situation because I'm prone to saying stupid things when I go into the red. And we saw that on the basketball court the other night. Like, you get into the red, and next thing you know, you're saying things, and you're just so mad that you can't bring it back. And it's, far be it for me, as me, to say his behavior, Westbrook, is right or wrong. The perfect thing would have been security. Hey, hop over here. This dude's throwing racial stuff at me. Please have that guy hauled out.
Exactly.
But it's not that easy. There are a lot of open wounds that date back centuries, that predate any of us, that I can't speak to those wounds. it's farcical for me to say that I could. So I understand why he gets mad, because you hear something like that and he's like, I can't believe I'm hearing this. This is 2019. I shouldn't have to deal with this, and I'm going to deal with it myself.
Exactly. And so you got to just hope that what comes out of this is they can vastly reduce the occurrences like this in the future, like they've done after the brawl with the Pistons and the Pacers. But the thing for Westbrook, and I think the reason the NBA went a little bit easier on him than they normally would have, is not only what was said, but there has been history with Westbrook in Utah and Westbrook on the court in the last 12 months. Last spring, the Thunder lost to the Jazz in the playoffs in Utah, and there were some instances where he was leaving the court where there were these altercations. There was the one where the fan was putting the cell phone in his face and he pushed it out of the way. That was last year in Utah.
Yeah.
And then this week, a week before the incident in Denver, the fan touches Westbrook on the court, and it's because it's the front row at midcourt, and then he's talking to the fan who was a kid.
Yeah.
He's talking to the kid and the kid's parents.
Yeah.
And trying to tell them that's not okay. And so you understand that Westbrook specifically has had some significant history with the altercations or with the interactions with the fans, and the NBA has not done enough up to this point to protect the players because he's getting touched on the court.
Yeah.
People are putting cell phones in his face as he's leaving the court in Utah. And so why wasn't security able to nip this in the bud?
Yeah. Because
there was security in the area. How,
right.
Why didn't they step in here and stop this incident and just eject the fan right away?
Right.
And so I think the NBA is recognizing we have to do better here.
Absolutely.
And they, I'm sure they will going forward.
Well, you look at Westbrook after game six, and if you've watched even minutes of a basketball game that he's played in, you know what a competitor this guy is.
Oh, he's off the charts.
He's like Allen Iverson as far as a dude who will just lay it all out there. And I enjoy watching him for that reason. He's like Zion in terms of the fact that there are times in the game where he's speed-wise, strength-wise, jumping out of the gym-wise, he's just at another level. Like, he's playing a different game than other people.
He has to be the guy in the NBA that expends the most amount of energy consistently every single game.
But
it's like the guy has six cups of coffee before every possession.
But you go out and when you know that guy wants to win that much and is that much of a competitor, like, that basically is like the lady who is trying to take a selfie with a jaguar and wonders why she got scratched. Like, well, this guy is a 100% competitor that if I was saying I'm picking a starting five, I'd be hard pressed to say he wasn't on it because he's just an intense dude. And I love watching him play. But when you stick your cell phone in that guy's face after game six and his team's been eliminated, sorry, you get what you get. Like, because if somebody did that to me, if we got knocked out of the men's league playoffs, I'd probably slap the phone out of their hands too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate that as well for him. I appreciate how hard he plays, how much of a competitor he is. I think that is absolutely something to look up to. At the same time, he's one of my least favorite players in the NBA because he doesn't value the ball. He doesn't care about turnovers. He doesn't care about missed shots. He runs one of the best players in the NBA out of his city, Kevin Durant, because he won't pass him the ball. Even though Kevin Durant is a much better scorer, much more efficient shooter, he doesn't really know where to draw the line on some of his decisions on the court.
You're completely accurate.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he's just, there's a lot going on with him, both positively and negatively.
Yes. But he's fun to watch. Unquestionably a competitor. We should probably talk about Bedford Sports, just saying.
Well, all of these things affect Bedford Sports.
Yes.
They trickle down.
We've been talking about basketball for 45 minutes. Hockey, we got to see. So my prognostication before the playoff finals last Saturday
way off
was there's going to be bonus hockey.
Well, who could blame you?
No.
The last two games leading into it, two overtime games, the total of three overtimes.
Right.
2-1 final and a 3-2 final.
Yep.
So you'd think, makes sense, this is going to be a close game. Trinity's on a run. They belong here.
Yep.
Let's get ready for some extra hockey.
And, well, it was not to be.
No, it wasn't.
No. That thing was over from about 5 minutes in the second period.
Yeah,
right after halftime.
What a dominant performance. Just the amount of shots that Bedford took, got on net, the amount of time they had the puck in their offensive end. To wrap up the season with a 7-0 victory in the state championship was just outstanding.
It was really a lot of fun to see that. The Robertos combined for what, four goals? Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Owen had three. I think Parker had one. We had Steve Tempesta next to us up in the rafters at the SNU Arena or the Verizon Arena. Or what, you know, I still call it the Verizon because that's what I know it as, but SNU Arena. And he was giving us the intel on the players on the ice at any given time. But really a lot of fun. And as we got close to the end of the game, the question became, is this going to be clean? Is this going to be 7-0?
Right.
Or is Trinity going to push one in late?
That was the only drama in the third period.
But, well, I mean, once it got to 7, they started the running clock. But Bedford's goalie, Shea Gaumond, came through with some nice saves late in the game. And really credit to him for keeping his focus up. Up 7-0, I mean, we've all been in that situation. You make, if it's basketball, you make a silly turnover and somebody hits a three on the other end. If it's baseball and you're up big, you groove a fastball or just a get me over fastball and somebody hits it 800 feet, you get next strain. Like, you lose the shutout in a ridiculous way, but this kid was bound and determined that he was going to get a shutout, and he did.
Yeah, they really finished it off. And one of the other things that I took away from it talking to Steve Tempesta during the game was his talk about Bedford's conditioning and how he thought that made a big difference. The conditioning they went through throughout the preseason and season to be in this position where you're in the state championship in this big rink, the ice is softer than usual because it's warmer in the arena.
Yep.
There have been all these games, and Bedford's been in that position before to know what the conditions are, not just the psychological conditions of a state championship, but the actual differences in the ice in a setting like that. And they were more prepared to excel in that context because of their experience and their training. And that really jumped out to me in terms of Steve's analysis during the game.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that and hear that. And just overall for them to, and from talking to Jason Bergeron too, Jay pointed out these kids have played together for so long, Bedford and Trinity. There's so much spillover among club teams that they all know each other and they all know each other's tendencies. And we've talked about it with some of the other coaches, how it can be difficult for them at the varsity level to mesh teams that, for all intents and purposes, all right, this might be the philosophy with this program, but this might be the philosophy with this program. How do you get everybody just to go in the same direction after the same goal, pun not intended? But how do you get everybody to push the same way when certain coaches have certain ways of rewarding, punishing systems? And it's tough. It's a challenge. And with hockey, it's always been there because there's always been some sort of junior hockey program. You see it more so now with basketball because so many kids are playing AAU baseball where there are club teams. But it really... And then you see the fact that you know people on the other bench, and you're playing for not just the pride of your school against these nameless, faceless people. You're playing for pride against people that you're going to see soon at a practice somewhere or on the ice somewhere, at a workout somewhere, maybe in college. Like, that's an interesting piece that goes along with it, is just the relationships that all these kids have with each other, both on their team and outside of it.
Yeah, Bedford overcame all of that. They had various obstacles during the season. They had that 4-0 loss, and they rebounded well. So you got to give credit to Coach Myers for getting that team to peak at the right time and to be able to finish off those two overtime games. You know, you often think about winning the first overtime game. How are you going to react the next game? Are you going to have a letdown due to fatigue, physical or mental? But he had him ready to win that second game against a team that didn't want to go away. That was the extra game, right, with the coach that coached for 42 seasons. So their players were doing everything they could to extend that season, his career, not to mention their own.
Yep.
But to win those two playoff games in overtime and then finish it off 7-0, you know, props to Coach Myers and congratulations to the entire program.
Yeah, a lot of fun to watch that. And then we had discussed having Maddie Lucantoni on with us as she gets ready for her senior year of softball. A couple updates on Maddie. She was first team All-State for hockey. So congratulations to her, selected for the All-Star Make-A-Wish game. 28 goals this year. she scored out of the defensive side.
That's more than one per game.
It's crazy. And then
that's a good number.
She was selected as one of 38 football players in New Hampshire to receive the 2019 National Football Foundation Scholar Athlete Award in April. But and she was really excited. This is coming straight from her in an email. Her little brother got the sportsmanship award for JV boys hockey.
All right.
So, yeah. So, congratulations to the Luke and Tonys. And of course, Maddie is going to play hockey next year at Assumption College. So we will, as always, be excited to follow the path of Maddie as she continues on her journey. So, with that said, I know we had a handful of other items that we wanted to talk about. You've been watching a lot of golf.
Yeah.
We're getting back to the Phil Mickelson track.
Yeah, it's the Players this week. It's an exciting tournament, you know, known as the fifth major. Now it's in March instead of May.
Yep.
So we've got this big tournament with all the big names before the Masters. And this, of course, is the tournament. If you haven't been watching, we're taping this on Friday. This is the Island Green 17. And it's a phenomenal hole, signature hole, one of the most famous par threes in the world. And there were articles written about it before the tournament that I sent you. And there are just so many fascinating anecdotes from this hole. You've got Fred Couples getting a hole-in-one there in 97, and then in 99, he hits one in the water, tees it up again, and then flies that shot directly into the hole for a three. You've got Paul Azinger making a two there on a bomb putt when he was at Q School that he said changed his career forever. Because
isn't that crazy?
He got his card by one stroke.
Yep.
And it was that 17th hole he hit a long birdie putt. And then, of course, the flip side is that 11% of professional shots go in the water. So more than 1 out of 10 of those guys that step up to that
on that hole. I'm like, what?
11% go into the water. And coming into the tournament this year, there'd only been 8 holes in one on that hole. But yesterday in the first round, you saw the whole range again. You saw Paul Casey hit 2 balls into the water and then make a 7. You saw Ryan Moore fly one off the flagstick about a foot and a half up, and then it came down and damaged the lip of the cup and went in for a hole in one. So he gets a hole in one. Paul Casey gets a 7. Casey's going to miss the cut. Ryan Moore is at the top of the leaderboard. The fortunes of these players, both in this tournament and sometimes for their entire career, shift on this very one hole.
It's almost like the most cliched thing in golf. Every 17th hole is a par three, short par three over water. And well, it's a test. I mean, you get to a point late in your round where, and I know golf isn't basketball where Russell Westbrook or Zion Williamson are running up and down the court, but mentally it's a drain. You're taking a good amount of swings, even more so if you're a bad golfer. And you're a little bit just mentally tapped out. And they throw this 17th hole over water in there. In this case, it's got an island green. They throw that in there as a, can you focus? Can you get it together? Because a great golfer will look at that and they see the hole. The rest of us look at the hole or at that and see water.
Right.
And really, that's the difference between a great golfer and the rest of us is you walk up and they're looking at what the goal is and the possibilities, and the rest of us are looking at the obstacles.
Yeah, and the takeaway that I got from this article was the overwhelming strategy that most agreed is most effective is just try to hit the middle of the green. Don't even look at the pin.
Right.
Because they're going to put it at a place where you think, well, if I hit it right in this spot and I get the little backstop, I might get a hole in one. But what you really want to do is just hit the middle of the green, try and get a par, and play it like Jason Duffner, who in all his years has never hit it into the water on that hole. So some guy
he's just, Duffnering.
Duffnering is really hitting that green. That's what it should be.
Duffnering is sitting inattentively in a children's classroom. Yes, you saw the pictures.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's what Duffnering has
been
to known to be. But what it should be is looking at that green and just scoffing at the water and just zeroing in on the very middle of the green and then hitting your shot there with a 9-iron or wedge, depending on the wind, every time. That's really what Duffnering should be.
For a professional golfer, too, they're thinking of other things than we are as far as, like, spin rate, backspin, everything that goes along with it, they know, all right, if I stick it there, can I actually stick it or is it going to spin off the thing? Like, they're thinking of things that you and I...
Next level.
I mean, I used to factor that stuff in. Now I'm just happy if I actually get to golf and, like, you know, my ball doesn't get eaten by the clown.
Right. Like,
I mean, that's really all I'm going for. But I don't know. So, it has been interesting to watch the players. Of course, the players dealing with the island green more so than anything else. But, I mean, that's what makes for good TV.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, the other side of it is that mental side that you just referenced. The way that it's set up is fascinating because you've got the 16th green on the water, the other side of the water. So they have to make this long walk around the lake and sort of look at that 17th green and start to think about it. And fun anecdote from that article in Golf Digest was what happened last year with Webb Simpson, the winner. What did his caddy do? Well, he had this plan going into the final round of exactly what he was going to talk about on that walk, which was he started talking about the NBA. He started talking about Golden State and Houston and which was the better team out west. And apparently it helped relax Webb and he was able to keep his ball dry and go on and win. But, you know, the other thing you can't forget with this green is Ricky Fowler, who when he won it in that playoff on a Sunday, he had to play that hole three times. He made a birdie two, three times on that hole in one day to take home the trophy. So we'll see how these guys do over the weekend on that hole and who can take home the trophy.
And speaking of playing three times, Saturday, Duke UNC, this time Zion plays.
That's right.
So we'll see what happens. I'm tuning in just because it'll be fun to watch. That's really it. Also in the world of sports, the Steelers give up Antonio Brown for a box of old pinball machine parts.
Unbelievable.
He's only had 100 receptions the last 6 years in a row. Give me a third and a fifth round pick. Like, really?
No. One of the craziest stats I heard on that one was his average over the last 6 years is something like 112 catches for 1,549 yards.
Yeah.
That's his average season. No Raiders receiver has ever hit either of those marks in a single season.
I was going to say Todd Christensen had 100 catches for the Raiders once.
No, must not have been
ages
one,
ago.
Must not have been 112.
No, he didn't. And OBJ to the Browns.
That just came out of nowhere.
That was bizarre. Yeah, but they're going to be really good.
They got a lot of talent all of a sudden. And the crazy thing I hadn't really realized and put all together was I read what the Giants got for him. I didn't think it was enough. A first, a third, and a player. But the fact that they just signed him last offseason to a five-year deal where they gave him a $20 million signing bonus, they really flushed a bunch of cash down the toilet, where if they had had an actual long-term plan, they would have franchised him and then traded him and saved upwards of $20 million in actual cash and dead cap space money. You know, this was calculated by Bill Barnwell in a great article on ESPN that you can find evaluating the trade. But both of these trades, I just don't understand why those teams would make those deals for what they did. If you look back at the Khalil Mack trade, the Bears had to give up two firsts.
Yeah.
They traded a second and a third and a sixth for Khalil Mack. So if he's worth two firsts and additional draft picks, how is Antonio Brown only worth a third and a fifth? As it turns out, what the Raiders did was they traded Khalil Mack, got Antonio Brown, and they got two first-round draft picks out of it. I mean, I think they were – I wouldn't call them a big winner in the Khalil Mack trade, but they got a pretty impressive haul for it. I mean, it's – I think it's maybe a 50-50 type deal. I mean, they got a lot of assets back. But you combine that with the Antonio Brown trade, they're doing great things.
Yeah, and so now Gruden may be putting himself in a position to – put a winner in Oakland or Las Vegas or wherever they wind up.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks to Hanson and I for talking for an hour straight. That was good. That was like a new world record here.
Yes, sir.
Around these parts. Thanks to Harry, Colleen, and Bill for all their help in getting the show on the air. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.